Welcome everyone to episode number 115 of Underserved. Joining me today is Dom Scandinero, CTO at Cameo. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Dom, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. I'm excited to be here.
So way back when you were a kid, how were you first exposed to technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think from super early on, like 7, 8 years old, I was just really curious about how things worked. Parents would get me a gift and I would kind of take it apart. And sometimes I'd be able to figure out how to put it back together. Sometimes my mom would be upset with me that I destroyed it and it was broken and they wasted the money getting me the gift. I remember at one point taking a lamp in my bedroom and cutting the electrical cord and then just rewiring the positive and negative again and plugging it back in. My mom found that some electrical tape over top of it and threw it away. And I was very upset, but I think she's probably making the right decision at the time as well. Lucky enough to have a early Apple computer in the house, pre-internet as well, and get to play around with it probably before I was 10. But my dad took a really special interest in my love for technology and my passion for it. And really early on, he was like, I think we can just like learn how to build a computer together. And I remember just thinking he was absolutely out of his mind. At the time, that just felt like a thing that not only could me and my father not figure out to do, but felt like nobody that, you know, didn't work at, I don't know, IBM or Apple or something would actually know how to do. But, you know, he looked it up, found out there was an expo that happened regularly in our local neighborhood. So we went to the convention center. We were walking up and down the aisles. My dad's a very extroverted person. So he was chatting people up, you know, at the booth that sold motherboards and the booth that sold hard drives. And, you know, just kind of every single part of the computer had its own different vendors that were selling it. But he was just meeting them, making relationships, exchanging phone numbers. And we, I think, left that very first computer show with all the parts of a computer, put it together. I'm sure we leaned quite a bit on those relationships that he made there to ask questions when we couldn't figure out how to connect one piece to the other. I remember just struggling like crazy to figure out how to get the right drivers installed. These things today, I feel like every gamer puts together their own computer, and you know, anyone that even isn't that interested in technology has kind of figured out how to do this super common. But at that point, this just felt to me like completely mind-blowing that my father thought of the fact to do this, to bring me through the entire experience. And then also he was a bit of a serial entrepreneur. He founded quite a few companies over the years, I think like 50 plus at the end of the day. But one of them he decided to create was called Scandinero Computers, just our last name. We started building computers for other people. We started going back to that same convention center for the same trade show where we bought all the parts and having a booth and selling fully built computers to people that were coming to that computer show to try and find one for less expensive than they could buy them at like the big box CompUSA or whatever at that point. And along with the computer came in-home installation and kind of basic training on how to use the mouse and keyboard, how to do word processing, that sort of stuff. And my dad was sending me with him into these people's homes to teach them how to use the computer. And that was kind of my contribution to the business. I don't think that was a successful business revenue-wise by any means, but it was a really pivotal moment to me early in my career to kind of continue to fuel my passion for technology and make it really clear to me that something in that area is definitely what I wanted to do for my career later in life.
Now, you got to try out some programming in high school now too, right?
Yeah, I went to school at a pretty great high school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania called Central Catholic. I think it was pretty rare at the time that a high school had all that many programming classes, but we had a Pascal class, I think, was my first formal programming class taught by a teacher in school. And that was probably in like 9th or 10th grade. And I just absolutely loved it. Like completing the assignments we were given in class, I loved playing around with it at home and building my own little programs. I even remember getting into a little bit of trouble in school trying to like use the netsend command to send messages from one computer to another to trick a kid into like going to the principal's office thinking they were in trouble and that was a message from the school and it was really just like one of us in the back of the class like screwing around. So really enjoyed programming from my first taste of it.
And then you even, while you were still in high school, got to take a college level course, right?
Yeah, so my school was pretty closely associated with the University of Pittsburgh. a few different disciplines, I think, a chance to take like a 100 level class that was actually taught at my high school, but followed the same curriculum as the college. So I think it was like a CS100 type class. It was specifically in Java. Continuing to go down the path of programming was super interesting, but at the same time, their curriculum was very math focused. And I was never like somebody that loved math. So it was writing a program where there were like 10 questions on an exam or a take home assignment. And it was take these matrices in, do this sort of matrix multiplication and export the answer to a text file or something like that. And that was, from what I remember, every single assignment, every single test was basic math like that written by the computer. And that was probably a really, really good way to teach you CS, but I just found it really boring compared to something like building a website or something that has a user interface.
Now, you were also a sprinter in the 100 to 400 meter range. How did that kind of inform your college decision?
Yeah, I mean, it basically made the decision for me. Well, I played soccer since I was three. And my dad was like super involved in soccer. He coached a bunch of soccer teams. I think he coached like a under 18 women's national team at some point. So he was really, really involved in getting me into soccer and like kind of shepherded me through the late grade school and early high school process. But by the time I was like a sophomore in high school, I hated soccer since I've been playing it since I was three. I was always the fastest kid on the field. And I had just done track in ninth grade for the first time. And I was really good at it. I was doing it for the first time when a lot of other people had been doing it since early on and still competing with them really successfully. But on the soccer side of the house, I started to get some interest from some colleges and some, I think it was too early to get like a formal offer, but early soft offers around going to school at different places in Pittsburgh, you know, some of it being paid for by the university. So my parents were very, very disappointed when I decided to quit soccer and dedicate my time to track all year round because I just enjoyed it because it was newer to me and different. So fast forward to junior year, a couple of different schools were interested. I was visiting and talking to them, but Wheeling Jesuit University in Wheeling, West Virginia is where I ended up going to school. The back and forth was something like early in a week or end of a week, they sent over an offer to pay for, I think, everything but room and board for scholarship if I ran track and field there. And my parents were like, all right, you're doing this. Like, you don't have any other option. I think it came with like an exploding deadline of end of the week or start of the next week. So we just made the decision that that was definitely where I was going to go. Obviously, we had looked at the fact that they had a good CS program that we were interested in as well. But just the combination of those two things made it an obvious decision that there was really no other option to.
I trust there was less matrix multiplication there in the CS program?
At least from what they showed me before I started, there was zero of it. I think they did a really good job. I got to go out there and go to a couple classes. The class they brought us into was like a very advanced computer science class, maybe junior or senior year students. And they were all presenting a really big project that they must have worked on for months. So it came off really, really well as compelling content to get you to want to go there. And all of the things that were being presented were like Visual Studio built type applications where there was user interface and it was the front end of some application. So, you know, there was visual representation of what you were doing. There were buttons you were clicking versus, you know, stuff that was purely at the command line. Obviously, once I went to school, learned that there was quite a bit of stuff that was at the command line as well, but theirs was still much less math-based and more like the typical, you're a library writing the software of checking in and out a book type thing via the command line versus purely everything being 100% math, which was a lot more fun in my opinion.
Now they had a partnership with NASA as well, right?
Yeah, I had an advisor freshman year, Patrick Plunkett, who was my CS teacher. I think he was the head of the CS department. And NASA had a facility on our campus called the National Technology Transfer Center. And I think they had just like one internship for CS specifically, where you were just building websites for local government funded organizations in West Virginia. So like local initiatives to prevent forest fires and preserve water and that sort of stuff. They're just going through them kind of one by one. I'm guessing there was a whole queue of them that had applied for a free website. And they were just basically leveraging the intern and a few of their employees to build these. So I think there was a senior that was working there and they must have been graduating my freshman year. So they were starting to look for the next person. And thankfully, Mr. Plunkett had recommended me. And I think there's probably like a quick, easy interview and I got the gig. And it's one of those stories of you learn so much at your first job compared to what you learn in academia over the years. So I'm super, super thankful for that opportunity. It's the only time I got to learn web development. We didn't have classes on it in school yet at that point. So I got to learn all about MySQL as a database and writing a web application that was the front end to that all for the first time, just kind of on the job while getting compensated for it, which was super cool. So I did that, I think, sophomore and junior year.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast.
Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group,
embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
And so after getting both experience in the classroom and at work, where do you go to work after school ends?
So after I graduated, I moved to Chicago, and I was just super excited to explore a different part of the country. To me, Chicago was this massive city coming from Pittsburgh, which was super blue collar at the time.
Chicago's a massive city coming from anywhere.
That's true. But I was just looking for anything as my first job. You know, it's not easy to get that first gig. And I ended up at a spot called Creedon & Associates that actually one of my good friends still works at today. But they were a small mom and pop company, been around for probably 60 or 70 years at this point. They were a manufacturer's representative, which is a long story in the hardware space, but they had a sales enablement software. They had a big sales force of, I think, a salesperson in each state across the country. And they had a Palm Pilot that they were taking in and out of stores with them all day. And it was completely offline. So every night they would plug it into their computer and it would replicate or sync over to our servers. And they would get information about new products that were available for sale and their current prices. And all of their orders would sync up to our system. So it was a completely new thing for me to get a chance to work on, which was really, really fun. I had a Palm Pilot as my phone at some point when I was in college. So it was cool to write my first application for that and get to work on a code base with other people, you know, at a real professional job for the first time. Some of those websites I worked on were a lot of just me by myself quite a bit. But ultimately, it parlayed really quickly into mobile development while I was working there. The second iPhone came out with third-party apps on it, and Google Android came out with apps, I think, from the start, roughly at the same time. And we evaluated both platforms, but based on just like things that the OS let you access as far as GPS location and that sort of thing, we decided to go with Android. And we brought in an outside contractor, and I got to learn Android programming from the start on the job at that first position. So we just replatformed the main application that was on Palm Pilot over to Android. And I got to write almost all that code, I think, myself, the help of that contractor that was kind of teaching me along the way and code reviewing stuff and pointing me in the right direction here and there. And I just immediately fell in love with mobile and Android and even iOS as well, and just, you know, got my first taste of it and kind of never looked back from there.
Oh, those were the good old days. I remember, like, you know, discovering Android development. I'd known Java since the late 90s. I'm like, oh, this is all I have to do in order to make an app and an APK and deploy it to my phone. Like, this is easy. It's definitely gotten a little more difficult, but it was a lot of fun back then. We talk a little bit about this to make a callback to the episode with our guest, Bob Hammond, where we talk about early app dev and also placing those little mobile ads inside them. So after Creedon & Associates, where do you end up working?
So I went to a company called Sellit, which was like C-E-L-L-I-T, which I think was a made-up verb, like to make compatible for a cell phone. And they were kind of the perfect place for me as far as my interest goes. I was just getting really excited about iOS and Android development. They were looking for an Android developer, I think. And I applied only with like two and a half years of experience at that point in my career. I got hired pretty quickly. And it was like a 15, 20 person shop, really small place. And their business was something like half a SaaS product for mobile marketing. So text message marketing, like you go to a restaurant, you sign up for text and you get deals in the future. So we had a platform where marketers could just pay a monthly cost to subscribe to that and manage their lists and send out their messages. And then in addition to that, we did consulting with the other 50% of our resources for app development for iOS, Android, and eventually Windows Phone. And then also mobile website development, back when people would actually build a separate website for mobile to cut down on bandwidth and all that sort of stuff versus just have responsive design like we have today. So I got to work on all of that really from the start, and it was just really, really exciting to keep learning new things and get to build different apps and, you know, be able to show my friends and family these things that I worked on out in the wild.
You also got very much into PHP development, specifically around APIs and using it as a front end for web applications.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I think when I was in college and building those sites, it was in ASP. And then I think at Creedon & Associates, it was like ASP.NET maybe for some of the stuff we were doing on the web, and obviously Java for the Android stuff, as you mentioned. And all those languages are really great. But PHP was the first introduction I had to a language that could kind of do anything. You could build an API backend. You could build a framework for rendering the front end HTML. You could send text messages. Our backend was built on a, you know, a queuing system with PHP that was just reading and writing from a queue and communicating with the telephony companies to be able to send out those text messages to our customers. Or you could build a script that could do anything locally on your computer as far as automating pieces of your job or really doing just about anything. So it was my first time being introduced to a language where it was just like one tool that could do any job. And it was just like really, really addicting to be able to code anything in my life if I was interested in doing it. And it was my first time working a lot more on the back end as well. So doing some of the work on the front end of the applications, but getting to work on the back end APIs that would serve up the apartments that were listed in the app or where you would put out a bid on a car that was for sale in one of the apps as well. And I just really enjoyed that kind of position of working between the business logic on our side and some of these other companies that we were working with to collect all the inventory on their side and then display it within the app on our side. And just really loved the challenge of looking at other people's documentation and figuring out how to integrate our systems with theirs, which was just always a fun challenge day in and day out.
But after that company got acquired, you decided, I think I want to do something new somewhere else. So what do you do?
Yeah, I think I stuck out there for a bit and worked on integrating our mobile marketing platform into theirs and working a bit with the mobile engineers they had. But yeah, after a year or two, I started looking for something new, and the company was called If by Phone at the time. I think they changed their name to Dialogue Tech while I was there. And they were doing something really cool in the marketing automation space that was super new to me. Basically, everyone was buying Google Ads. And if you had something you just put in a shopping cart and bought, Google had really good attribution data. So you knew one ad you were running was super successful because it had, you know, a conversion rate of 5%. And this other ad wasn't because it had a conversion rate of 1% or whatever. But if you sold something that people called on the phone to buy instead, you had a lot less clarity into if your ads were actually performing unless you like asked the person on the phone how they heard about you and exactly which ad they saw and had somebody write all that down on the back end. So they had a pretty innovative idea to actually just cycle through a bunch of different phone numbers. So for each business, you got a pool of phone numbers and you installed our product SourceTrack on your website and you wrapped any phone number you wanted to be controlled by our system in some simple HTML tagging and, you know, just put our JavaScript snippet on the page. And we just replaced that default contact CS phone number with a different phone number for each person. And while they're on the website, we were heartbeating and just confirming they were still there, monitoring which pages they went to, which source they came in from. So it kind of had dual purpose functionality. On one hand, we got to tell you this person that called and ultimately purchased came through this ad. So you knew which ads to invest more in and which ones to iterate on. But also the benefit to the customer was we knew what they were looking at on the website when they called. So if they were staring at the FAQ page, we could send them to customer service. If they were, you know, hovering over a book button, we could send them to sales. And I think it added a lot of value, not only to the business, but to the customer, that they didn't have to answer a bunch of questions in a phone tree, sit on hold waiting to talk to the right department or get transferred around. But instead, we could just send them right to the person they wanted to talk to based on their browsing.
Now, your next job has one of the greatest names, Luxury Garage Sale. What are you doing there?
I think that it's definitely the place I've worked that some people know, maybe like 5% of people had name recognition for it. And the other 95% thought it was probably something to do with cars or car parts or something like that because of the garage in the name. But they were in an interesting business of high-end consignment. So people might buy a really expensive purse and it could be literally like $20,000, $50,000, some of these handbags went for. And they actually hold their value really well over time. So you could buy one, have it for, you know, a season or a couple of years and then decide to come to a company like us and consign it. The RealReal is a much more successful version of the same thing that a lot more people have heard of and has brick and mortar stores in cities like New York and Chicago today. So that's kind of the much more successful, well-known comp of what we were doing back then. But it was an interesting technical challenge. They were kind of moving from brick and mortar to digital as I joined. So they had physical stores in Chicago, a couple others across the country, but their website really only had a subset of their products and was all built on top of Shopify, which was talking to Salesforce and just a very complicated web of off-the-shelf technology. And we kind of worked to re-platform that product and kind of the entire company over to being more digitally focused and focused on just selling the products on e-commerce, really trying to leverage any technology that was available to us to help humans that were in our warehouse processing the goods that were on consignment. You'd mail in the thing you wanted to sell, and it would have to go through a bunch of different departments on our side manually. So, you know, somebody would unpack it, and another person would review its quality, and another person would authenticate it. So, you know, there's a lot of advanced fakes out there in this industry. So having experts to actually be able to review it and know what they're looking for and know if it's authentic or not before we would sell it was really important. Ultimately, it ends up getting photographed and somebody's writing individual copy for each of these things. A lot of them are very unique, and pricing it and listing it ultimately on our website and shipping it to one of the brick and mortar stores where they thought it would sell best. So there's just so many things in that whole chain. You can probably think about how technology would be able to help with. We experimented with ML to predict what the price should be, as well as how long it would take to sell. We tried to help predict which store it should go to based on which market we thought would be most interested in the product based on our previous sales data. And it was just fun to be able to help these people out that were kind of just doing this grind of working in this warehouse and manually opening all these boxes and taking pictures, and just being able to help them with technology be more productive and enjoy their job more day to day was really fun.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh, actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
Now, in the building, you made some friends from across the hall. How does that help when you're looking for your next opportunity?
I sure did. It might be the shortest journey that anyone's ever had in the history of distance from one job to the next. The place that I moved on to next was Mac and Mia. They had similar investors to some of the folks that had invested in Luxury Garage Sale, and they were also in the fashion space. If you've heard of Trunk Club is a business that was started in Chicago, super successful, and ultimately exited to Nordstrom. It was Trunk Club for kids. So instead of adults going in to meet with a personal stylist and, you know, buy some clothes or, you know, enter into a program where they get shipped new clothes every month, this was very focused on kids. So specifically targeting busy moms and working with them to help their kids have fresh outfits for each season and not have to worry about going out and shopping for all that, but instead just leveraging our team and our product to give them new clothes for every season. And it was a really cool idea because it also leveraged the idea that there are a lot of stay-at-home moms that are looking to get back into the workforce. So all of our salespeople were actually moms themselves, who many of which had worked previously, but were, you know, stay-at-home moms since having children and wanted to get back into it. So they were part-time trying to get new people signed up and earning commission on folks that were signing up for the platform and getting a new box of clothes for, you know, each month or each season. So I joined to kind of build out a new team and kind of shift them to a new stack and a new website. Unfortunately, they were closing a Series B round when I started, and closing that round didn't go as successfully as planned, or didn't happen at all. And pretty quickly we were winding down the business, and I was looking for what's next, which kind of leads me to Cameo. It was a really interesting opportunity to like have a job and still be at Mac and Mia doing stuff like helping us sell old inventory on Shopify and literally like selling computers and desks and office chairs and that sort of stuff, just to get all of our vendors and employees paid and all that sort of stuff in my last month. But we knew, you know, the end date of the business, and there was a lot of flexibility obviously around interviewing, and I got to talk to probably 10 or 15 different Chicago businesses that were looking to hire, and got to chat with the folks at Cameo and see their office, and pretty quickly fell in love with everything they were doing and the people that were here my first trip to their office.
Now, for folks that aren't yet familiar with Cameo, I got to know them through their consumer offering, where celebrities of all levels and status are on there and offer to record a custom message for you at some length. I actually hired them to make a birthday greeting. Kate Flannery, who plays Meredith on The Office, made a birthday greeting for my daughter Julia 1 year, and it was pretty awesome to have something bespoke from this famous person that you could share. So from that, how does the technology work behind the scenes, and how has the business evolved into different offerings these days?
It's funny that you mentioned Kate Flannery. We've got a really close relationship with her. We actually have 52,000, I think is the latest number, celebrities and creators of all walks of earth, as you kind of described, on our platform. But I think I've met her in person twice now, once at our office when I joined back in 2019, and more recently, late last year, I think she was in our River North office as well. I think I have a photo of a few of us with her. But it's just kind of a crazy business that you have a chance to meet celebrities at work as well. But yeah, the tech is at its heart pretty simple, right? We've got a website and app front end for customers to come and discover people within that breadth of celebrities we offer. I think the more and more people we onboard, the larger that challenge becomes to kind of weed through all of the sea of faces to find the right person to make the perfect message for the loved one in your life. 80% of our purchases are gifts. So that's a pretty common problem, is like, you're not coming to the site knowing that you love a specific person and you want to get a video from them. You're usually coming to the site saying, I know that Andrew likes the specific sports team, but I don't really know enough about them to know which person to buy or ultimately what to write in the message to make it special. So trying to enable that is a big piece of our challenge. But it's all React as far as the web application, and React Native on the app side. So similar technologies, engineers can kind of switch context between the web and the app pretty easily. We use Node.js on the back end, and then we run completely on AWS. So all the videos get uploaded to S3, transcode them with FFmpeg to do things to like make a consistent video file size and type, but also to add the moving Cameo watermark on top of the video as well. So end to end, it's pretty simple, and a lot more of the complexity lies in just scaling for surges in traffic as certain celebrities go viral for different reasons, or Cameo often goes viral because of those celebrities as well, or different products that we've built over the years, like things like synchronous video calls, kind of like a FaceTime with celebrities. So the complexities lie more outside of the core product, I would say.
And then you have a different version of the app for the creators that allows them to do some basic editing and creation.
We've gone back and forth over this over the years. We have the same app, but just like a different half of the code base within that app. So if you log in as somebody that is approved for creating content and available for booking on the site, you have one view and you can kind of toggle into the fan mode if you do want to go purchase a video from somebody else as well. But yeah, it's all part of the same app that you find together in the app store. But yeah, the celebrity interface is very streamlined. Frequently, people aren't recording one video, they're recording many videos back to back. So they have a list of the requests, they can pop into one and kind of preview what it is about, who it's from, who it's to, what the occasion is. But then once they're ready to record, they go into a teleprompter experience where they've got all of the important details of the request overlaid on top of their video, and they record it start to finish. Most of them are really, really skilled at this sort of thing just because of, by nature, what they do for their career, or the fact they've been on Cameo for a while and have been doing it for years. They rip through them back to back to back. So record one, finish, it goes away and starts processing and uploading in the background while they go right into the next one. So you can imagine somebody doing like 10 or 20 of these back to back, and us just trying to build a product that stays as much out of their way as possible while just giving them the tools to record a really great video, quickly preview it, and then get on their way to the next one while all the back end tech happens and just stays out of their way.
Now, when you first got there, you had been looking at them for a while, but it seemed like there was only individual contributor positions open, and they gave you the old, join as an IC, and then don't worry, down the road, you'll make it into management. But that actually worked for you, didn't it?
It did, and I'm really thankful for this for a couple reasons. The first is that I'd looked at Cameo for a year plus probably before joining and never applied because there were only IC positions open, and I'd been in leadership or head of engineering jobs for the last maybe 10, 11 years before applying. So that incident at Mac and Mia, and like kind of the date I had in the future where I knew I'd be out of a job soon, and also the flexibility to not just focus on one or two potential opportunities, but instead be able to talk to 10 or more companies at the same time, gave me an opportunity to consider everything and have a really wide net. And and get to meet the folks at Cameo, which I probably wouldn't have done otherwise in a normal situation. But secondly, and most importantly, because it was the first time I got to join a company in many years at that point, not as a manager. And it's difficult to join as a manager and suddenly be managing many people who maybe a couple of met you in the interview process and had some say into you starting, but usually most of didn't and hadn't. So you have to like really scramble to prove your value to those people and to get them to trust you, which is a really, really difficult thing to do. But joining as an IC at a company that's growing super quickly kind of flipped that model on its head. So not only did I get to just write code all day, every day for I think it was like 5 or 6 months by the time I found a management position, but I got to work side by side with all the people that I would eventually manage and earn their technical respect just by doing my job and not having to go out of my way to do anything, you know, being their friend and coworker along the way. So when it came time for me to step up and be a manager, I already knew the people on the team. They already knew me. They knew that I knew how to do the work that I was asking them to do and not like that I was just throwing stuff over the fence that I had no idea how to do myself, which makes it a lot easier to be somebody's manager than the inverse. So I was super thankful for that.
Now, as a small business owner, as soon as I did that Kate Flannery one for Julia, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool to create an ad? But it seemed like the terms of service were at the time were kind of like, nah, this is just for, you know, happy birthday and making a joke and whatever. But since then, Cameo has made a new offering aimed at businesses, right?
Yeah. So our co-founders are all about keeping things simple. And our technical co-founder, that's like a really, really important value to him that he brings up every week. We've never really been like sitting there trying to dream up this whole new product we would build in the back room without talking to customers. But instead, we've tried to keep things really simple, right? Like they're started out with, I don't know, 10 or 20 talent on the website and a really simple, like one text input booking form to just write a paragraph and pay. And then I think celebrities even like recorded the videos and uploaded them through Telegram or something like that. And a bot picked them up on the back end. So started super, super light. And I mentioned that just to say, like, we try and look for customers that are power users of the platform and that are hacking what we've put together to try and do something else. So in this situation, I think we noticed that a lot of the customers that were buying videos, you know, were not only asking for them to the celebrity to endorse their sandwich shop or car dealership or what have you, but also that the email addresses were, you know, so-and-so at Microsoft.com, for example. And that was our first aha moment to be like, oh, look at this. People are actually using this to buy a video to endorse their company. And in many cases, the celebrities are not only willing to do it, but they're doing it for the same cost that they're doing the consumer video for it, you know, $500, $75, $100, something like that. So initially launched that new product as a really simple just toggle in the booking form. Are you booking this for personal use? Or are you booking this for business use? And I think something like a 5 or 10x multiple on the price. But that's evolved over the years to a completely bifurcated process where businesses have a different interface. They have a whole different set of people available. And those people set their prices very specifically to what they want to do for a business commercial. And ultimately, post-purchase, the experience is pretty unique as well. Because, you know, a consumer coming to our site and just buying one video, or maybe hopefully a few videos over the years, it's pretty easy for them to go back to either their email or their order page within our platform and find their videos. But if you're a business buying these for commercials, we have people that are buying hundreds of them, even people that have bought thousands. So they need a really great interface to be able to inventory all of those, to be able to re-download them and to ultimately manage licenses of them. We have different licenses you can buy depending on where you want to show the commercial and how long it's going to show for, to make sure the celebrity is properly compensated over time.
Tell me a bit about Cameo Kids, if you could.
Yeah, so this one's really exciting to me. About 2 years ago, I became the head of engineering at Cameo. And shortly after that, we started talking to a couple of different IP holders that came to us. One of the first ones I remember was the folks that own the IP for JJ from Cocomelon and the rest of the characters in that show. And they were just curious and exploring all avenues around being able to sell personalized video shout outs just like Cameo for the characters that they own the IP of and being able to expand that to other people in their portfolio. And there must have been something in the air because a couple different IP holders were kind of coming to us and having similar conversations at the same time. And being a technologist, I was just really curious about how we might be able to make some of this work on the back end ourselves. So these conversations were clearly very, very early and, you know, not highly confident that much was going to come of it. But I was just curious, like, what we could do on the back end to potentially be able to generate these videos ourselves and how dynamic and special we can make them. So I started experimenting with AWS Poly is a text-to-speech service from Amazon where you can choose between a bunch of different stock voices, send in any text you want. They give you some SSML capabilities to say, like, change the inflection in a certain area or make this part sound more high-pitched or low-pitched or what have you. But in general, it's just like, you know, give me a sentence and I'll give you back the MP3 of this voice saying the sentence. And I also stumbled across AWS Marketplace offering called Media Semantics, which was an API that would let you similarly give input of a series of movements that you wanted to create and give you back a string of, I guess, JPEG images that you could stitch together to make into a video of 2D format. So something like, you know, I want this character to wave, and you get back all of the frames of the actual video to make that character wave. And if you stitch those all together, you have a video. So I really quickly realized we could basically combine those two technologies in a Mad Lib style booking form and have you be able to come to the site and book a video from an animated character. And the beauty of that is the animated character is always available. They're always going to complete the video unless you're trying to get them to say something offensive. And they're going to do it really, really quickly. So, you know, 100% fulfillment, lower prices, and customer happiness was really, really compelling to us. Every year we have something called Cameopalooza where we have the whole company in Chicago the week of Lollapalooza. And I remember I decided, for better or worse, to do a live demo on stage of this new technology and talk about how we were trying to work with some of these partners later in the year to onboard these characters. So we had built our own animated character called Francisco the Fox, and it was built on one of those AWS Poly voices I was referencing earlier. Kind of, they have a generic cartoon sounding voice. And we had stitched this together where I had done a lot of back-end work and one of our now VP of engineering, Bronwyn, had done some of the front-end work to make the booking form work and get the details of the booking to this different service I was working on. But ultimately, I stood on stage very, very nervously while we typed in a request to Francisco the Fox for him to say something. And we sat there and we waited, refreshed the page and hoped that it fulfilled the video, because this was basically got it working, I think, the day or two before. And that video came back and we played it and everyone in the crowd just absolutely loved it. We had it live on the website for a couple of weeks for employees to be able to book, and they were all booking different silly things to say to one another, to friends and family in their life. And we then used that as kind of the example while talking to these IP holders about how this could ultimately work on our platform and what it would look like. And later, end of that year, so I think it was like December of 22, we launched Cameo Kids with a series of probably 5 or 6 characters for the first time. And it worked, you know, as the much more elegant version of what I was just talking about with Francisco. So very targeted at children only. So they won't say anything offensive or anything like that. But you just put in the to and the from. You choose an occasion. So birthday, potty training, getting them to brush their teeth at night. There's a whole array of options. And then we have a voice model where the voice actors of these characters have sat in a studio, worked with one of our partners, read thousands of lines. And ultimately, there's a voice model that we have API access to that works just like that AWS Poly model did with the generic voice, where we give it a string of text and it gives us back an MP3 file. And we create all the segments of the video, stitch them together with FFmpeg, and it goes into a human review queue for an IP holder to check out the video, make sure they're comfortable with what's being said, and then ultimately ship it off to the customer.
Very cool. Well, when you're not banging out new features like Cameo Kids, what are you doing for hobbies?
My partner and I love to travel. She has the travel bug and got me into that pretty early in our relationship. So we've been to really cool places like Tokyo, and I think Florence, Italy is probably one of my favorite places I've ever been. Also, I've signed up to run the Chicago Marathon this year. Despite being a track and field athlete in high school and college, I've never been good at distance running. So we'll be really lucky if I can crawl to the finish line before they close the race off. But yeah, this October, if you don't mind going out for me and cheering, that'd be really, really helpful. Also, I spend some significant time with a local charity called Black Girls Code. And it's a really cool initiative helping just underrepresented minorities in tech get access to the same sort of stuff we talked about me being excited about when I was 10 years old, early in their life. So I'm part of the Chicago chapter. We have events quarterly and they're all set up around a theme. So all of the girls come in and they each have a laptop and we walk them through some curriculum and start to finish, they build something. You know, there's obviously a lot of boilerplate and everything and a lot of, you know, follow these examples type stuff because we're not going to teach you to code start to finish in a couple hours. But one of the really fun ones was using AI to write a song. So you were able to use a bunch of different instruments. And I think it was like a Google provided tool. So you could lay out which different instruments you wanted to use. And then there was an AI flavor on top of it as well, where you could put some randomization into it. And then you write a little bit of code, usually in like a common language, like a Python, to just kind of conditionalize some of it as well. But you leave really, really excited, hopefully, and curious about what you just got a taste of. And the goal is that you go home and, you know, try a lot more of it on your own and come back to the next one, the next quarter, a few months later. But yeah, I'm really, really excited about that and love to get the word out and try and get more people into the program.
Very cool. Well, we'll make sure that we include that in the show notes, as well as links to further information on several of the topics we discussed today. Dom, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.